Balcony's first ever year-round bourbon was an inspiration. It all had to work together. A blend of carefully selected ingredients, Texas-sized pot stills, and creative people determined to find the absolute best way to usher a new whiskey along. When you discover how it pairs with a meaningful moment, suddenly the feeling of drinking great whiskey becomes a whole lot more.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Whiskey Neat, spirited conversations with interesting people. I am your host, Chris Ferrard. I'm going to pour myself a drink for this intro. So, as many of you know, growing up, I grew up in a teetotaler religion called UPC, United Pentecostal Church. Speaking in tongues, women couldn't cut their hair or wear, you know, jewelry. As I got older, as many of us do growing up, we realized that, you know, if you're told, don't do this, this is bad. As you get older and you're exposed to new things, you often find yourself realizing that things aren't always as bad as you're being told. Do as I say, not as I do, the whole nine yards. And I came to realize that alcohol can be a very beautiful thing. And of course, it's led to the show, it's led to the Whiskey Social, it's led to my liquor brands. It's something that, while I do recognize and acknowledge that there is a lot of dangers within the realm of alcohol, and anyone who's ever been to a corporate party can attest, but there's a lot of positives. And enter Edward Slingerland. There's a brand new book called Drunk, How We Sipped, Danced, and Stumbled Our Way into Civilization. And this book goes into great detail over our relationship with alcohol as a human race. Evidence of beer being around long before agriculture. How, you know, every business meeting, every peace treaty, every, you know, government, you know, two governments coming, two kings fighting over land, they always came together over drink, over food. There has always been something sacred about the act of sharing drinks with somebody. And this book goes into all of that. So today I sit down with the fantastic author, Edward Slingerland. He's based out of Vancouver. He's written a couple books. This one apparently was inspired by his previous book, Trying Not to Try. I read it out of order. This one covering alcohol was absolutely fantastic. So today I sit down with Edward Slingerland. And of course, we talk about the pros, the cons, the draws, the drawbacks, the nutritional aspects, everything there is to possibly talk about when it comes to alcohol. And I could not be a bigger fan of both him and, of course, a good pour. So this week, Whiskey Neat is brought to you in part by Legent Bourbon, a first-of-its-kind super premium bourbon that melds Kentucky distilling tradition with Japanese blending excellence. Legent is a perfectly balanced yet complex and layered whiskey with a bright, I'm not going to say smooth, I refuse to say it, unexpectedly long finish. Order a bottle today in your area via drizzly.com. And of course, as always, we always encourage you to please, please, please be safe. Alcohol can be a beautiful, beautiful thing, as talked about in this book in depth. But it does, you know, you've got to treat it carefully. And of course, all of our sponsors have that same message to be safe. As many of you know, we launched our website for Gregarious Grump, gregariousgrump.com. Our new website's up. We have more to come with that. And of course, our last sponsor, Amrut. Amrut, this year, the Food and Beverage Magazine's Proof Awards gave Amrut Single Malt a stunning 98 points and a double gold. As always, Amrut would like to thank our listeners for helping it be a success. Hopefully, we'll have another one of these soon. Big fan. And yeah, without further ado, please welcome Edward Slingerland from Drunk, How We Sipped, Danced, and Stumbled Our Way into Civilization. And buy it on Amazon. Get on Amazon. Boom. Cheers. Welcome to the show. I'm so excited to talk to you. It's very, very nice to meet you. And I couldn't be more excited to have you here. So thanks for doing this.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I went through, of course, I saw your great interview you did with Joe Rogan. I listened to the segments on Mark Gillespie's show with Whiskey Cast. I didn't get enough from it. I wanted to talk to you more. Okay. I grew up Pentecostal.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which is covered in the book.
Yeah.
And yeah. There's so much I got from your book about glossolalia, speaking in tongues.
Did you ever do that?
Yeah. So here's the thing. Our church growing up was very big on it. There was actually two versions of speaking in tongues. There's the one where one person speaks in tongues and another person interprets. And right. Then there's the full-blown Pentecostal hoedowns where everyone is just really going hard.
Everyone's doing it once, right?
Yeah. It's a very peculiar thing. When I met my wife, who was not Pentecostal, she had a lot of concerns just dating me because of where I come from. And I'm still friends with a lot of those people that are really, really good friends of mine. I'm no longer a practicing Pentecostal. And in fact, on top of doing this show, as many people who follow my show know, I own a couple of spirits brands and have worked in the liquor space for quite some time. So
okay. It seems incompatible with Pentecostalism.
100%. Yeah. Very, very incompatible. We were very big on UPCI, United Pentecostal Church. So it was all teetotalism, no alcohol whatsoever. In fact, I remember at one point I dated my pastor's daughter and we had a conversation about alcohol and he goes, alcohol doesn't taste good. So the only reason why you'd want to drink it is to get drunk and that's a sin. And it was this, to this day, this haunts me, right? At 34 years old.
I think. Right. Yeah. You're sinning. You're going straight to hell.
Oh yeah. Straight to hell. So it's been a subject that I've gotten a lot from. And let me catch people up here. So the book is called Drunk, How We Sipped, Danced, and Stumbled Our Way into Civilization. And because of how great this book was, I bought your other book, Trying Not to Try. So I can't wait to just soak you up, because I feel like so much of what you've spent your life writing about is, very apropos of my experience.
Okay. So and the books are related. It's actually material in the first book inspired the second one. So,
well, and you're a bit of a drinker yourself. I know you've talked a lot about Lagavulin 16 and the tax rates being so crazy in Canada. So alcohol has been my career for the past 6 years. And being someone who bottles spirits now full time, it's something that is obviously, you know, you have to be concerned about the genetic aspect, right? We've had alcoholics in my family growing up, which helped push us further into that whole Pentecostal thing, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
If your uncle's an alcoholic and your family goes super religious, it's literally a black and white issue for them. So your book goes into quite detail, quite a significant amount of detail about treating it more complicated than that, whether it's just good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know how you, how this led to, like, how did you get here? And did you have a deeply religious background? Like what pushed you into this?
No, I did not. I was raised kind of agnostic-ish, I guess, and then became a very committed intellectual atheist. So I'm not religious at all. So in a way, this project is similar in some ways to work I did earlier on religion. So I'm interested in mysteries that are hiding in plain sight. So there are a lot of things that humans do that we just take for granted that humans do. But if you start to think about them from an evolutionary perspective, they look really odd. And you have to explain what's going on. And religion's one of those things. So from an evolutionary perspective, it's surprising that individuals who believe in invisible spirits and who will undergo all sorts of costs for those spirits, they'll cut off the end of their foreskin, they will scarify themselves, they will refrain from drinking delicious whiskey or from eating delicious pork. They'll spend Sundays, their only day off, sitting in an uncomfortable pew listening to a boring sermon. They'll erect these enormous monuments to these beings that, as far as we know, don't exist. In early China, my area of specialty, the first emperor of Qin, you've probably heard of the first emperor of Qin's tomb. It's this big underground army. This was like years and years of most of the workforce of this state was put into building this underground army and throwing all these wealth in there. It was gold and bronze and then burying it. Like they just buried it. So why did groups that do that succeed? And they do succeed. Why wouldn't groups that didn't do that kind of thing and spent all their resources building real armies that could actually do something in the real world do better? And that's why you have to, when you look at all the costs of religion, you've got to assume there's some benefits that are paying for those costs. And I started to think that alcohol was like that too. It's such a costly thing. It's so dangerous for you physiologically. It's costly in all sorts of ways for both individuals and societies. And yet we've been producing and consuming alcohol for as long as we've been doing anything in an organized fashion. It predates agriculture. We were making alcohol in an organized way when we were still hunter-gatherers. And we've been doing it all over the world. Prohibition has not tended to catch on. Everyone's tried it and it rarely works. And so this is the puzzle. Why do humans continue to want to consume a low dose of neurotoxin? And it's got to be the case, given all the costs, that there are these benefits that we don't know about or we don't think about very much on the other side. So that's what kind of drove me into this project, was explaining the mystery of why people like to get drunk.
Well, and one of the things you discuss, you know, everything, especially nowadays, when it comes to anyone who has any kind of modicum of experience of Google using WebMD and diagnosing themselves, the subject of alcohol is largely around the health aspects of it, mm-hmm. the physical health aspect, nutritional facts, right? You mentioned in the book that there's been a long argument of you could have some, one drink a day versus the other argument saying that there is no net positive, that meaning that there, even in small amounts, alcohol consumption has a physiologically negative effect. But mm-hmm. no one is discussing the mental health aspect of it. All of the mental positives, the being able to turn off the prefrontal cortex and enjoy, you know, not think about the stresses in your life. Why do people end their day with a drink or two to kind of unwind and decompress? And the book covers all of it, both mm-hmm. the physiological negative effects, but also why are we not talking more about the general positiveness of it? And you mentioned that if it was only negative, then at some point throughout the evolutionary process, we probably would have just stopped drinking, but it continues to be something, a big part of who we are. And which means there's got to be more net positive to it than that, you know?
Yeah. And there's a good genetic solution to the problem. So if it really is just an evolutionary mistake, one possibility is just the mutation that would fix it hasn't happened yet. So evolution can't work on a variation that doesn't exist yet. So you can't select on something that doesn't exist. So it's possible that evolution's really pissed off about this and wants to remove our taste for alcohol, and it just hasn't figured out a way to do it yet, but it has. So there's actually two separate mutations that occur together in a couple different places around the world. The most famous example of it is an East Asian. So it's sometimes called the Asian flushing gene, but it's a set of mutations that affects your ability to metabolize alcohol. And when you have this set of mutations, why do we like to get drunk? The shallow answer is, well, because it makes us feel good. But that just pushes the question back. The real question is, why does it make us feel good? Why does evolution allow it to make us feel good? Because usually things that are bad for us make us feel bad. Sticking ourselves with a sharp object hurts, and we'd stop doing that, right? So evolution tells us when things aren't good for us usually. And this, if you have this set of mutations, if you drink a little bit of alcohol, you immediately flush, you get heart palpitations, you feel nauseous, you really don't like drink. So drinking makes you feel bad. And this mutation, as far as we could tell, arose about 7,000 to 10,000 years ago. in East Asia and probably around Southeast Asia. That's a lot of time for it to spread. So basically there's a genetic solution to the problem of why we like to drink. And yet it's just sat there. It stayed in that part of China. It spread a little bit to Japan and Korea, but it really hasn't moved anywhere. Whereas you would expect if really alcohol was just a net negative, that gene would take off everywhere. It would be everywhere in the world right now. So that's strong evidence to me that there's some countervailing benefits to being able to consume alcohol that are keeping that gene from taking over the human gene pool, essentially. And then with cultural evolution, you know, why haven't Pentecostals taken over the world? Pentecostals and Muslims should be it, right? And Mormons, right? We should, yeah. The benefits to not drinking are so great, and it seems, right, if it's only costly, that religious groups that ban it should by now have taken over the world, and yet they haven't.
Talk in the book about it's interesting because a lot of religion or at least the concept of God could have there's a theory out there, and correct me if I'm wrong if I'm butchering this because I consume this quite fast. I loved every word of it, but several theories out there, like the mushroom, the concept of God came through psilocybin. Or a lot of our religious ideas and visions might have been through intoxicants, which we eventually demonize as organized religion. We say that these things are bad, that these magical things really happened, and that they weren't the result of alcohol, but also alcohol in general is bad. So it's this weird balance where in the Catholic religion, wine is supported. The idea that
it's a sacrament. Yeah. It's in Christianity typically has had a very close relationship with wine, right? It's part of the sacrament. It's part of the most important ritual in Christianity is drinking the blood of Christ, which is wine. And as I point out in the conclusion to the book, the first miracle Jesus performs is not walking on water. It's not raising Lazarus from the dead. It's turning water into wine. And I love that story. He's at a wedding with his mom and his disciples, and they run out of wine.
Good wine.
And they run out of all wine, right? And so, and Jesus's mom is like, you got to fix this. And he doesn't want to show his power yet, but she's like, this is a serious emergency. We can't not have wine at a wedding. And so he goes and he turns, but my favorite part of the story is that he goes back, he turns the water into wine, the steward tastes it and is like, wow, this is amazing. And when he serves it, he says that he's violated the first rule of party planning, which is serve the good stuff first. So he's bragging that he's actually saved the good stuff for last. And I love it that even in, you know, the ancient Middle East, people had the same intuition, which is that don't serve your guests the good stuff at the end of the night. They're not going to be able to taste it anymore.
They're going to be able to enjoy it.
But that's significant that, wine is part of the fabric of human sociality, and religions know that. So actually intoxicants have been used by religions around the world and throughout history in a very symbiotic way.
Yeah. Growing up, we were told that the wine that Jesus turned into, the water that Jesus turned into wine wasn't, and this is what's a little, towards the end of the book, you basically make the point that we need to be evaluating a very, very complicated relationship in a more thorough way versus just painting with a broad brush. Mm-hmm. And growing up, we were told that the wine that he turned into, or the water he turned into wine, was actually grape juice, that it wasn't alcohol. And that back then, alcohol was a much more weaker substance, which is true. Both beer and wine were much more weaker back then. And back then, I think distilled spirits have only been around for about 12,000 years. Correct me if I'm wrong. But
much less than that. They're super recent. Distilled liquors are very recent on a large scale. Yeah.
Yeah. So what's manipulative about the whole wine thing is that the Bible clearly outlines in many areas, especially with Noah, the idea of being drunk, even if it was a weaker substance back then. But there is no reason to believe that the miracle that Jesus first committed was anything other than an alcoholic substance.
Yeah.
And it's always just been something that when it comes to the subject, especially through a religious lens, what are we choosing to ignore for the sake of the argument that you shouldn't touch it at all? And
we're ignoring all of the positive social benefits. So you're right that from a medical perspective, so there's two ways we tend to think about alcohol that are both, I think, unhelpful. One is this medicalized way. So it's just, we're only talking about physiological effects. And it's true that, so this, you know, article in The Lancet that came out a couple of years ago, got a lot of press, the safe level of alcohol consumption is zero because, you know, all this cholesterol benefits, whatever, it's the net benefits are negative. So from a medical perspective, you should drink zero alcohol. The other way people think about it is as this kind of sinful substance, which again, it's certain types of Christianity view it that way. In the Catholic Church, it's embraced as part of the Eucharist. In Italy, in Southern European countries, wine's woven into everyday life in a way that's foreign to this kind of American. There's a particularly American form of Puritanism and extreme religiosity. So these forms of Protestantism that are very fundamentalist, that view alcohol as this kind of, and other drugs as a kind of demon substance. And what we're missing there is just, and you know, and then there's a secular form of that, I think now, with this kind of, I call it a neo-asceticism, where there's, if you kind of meld the medical worldview and Puritanism, you get this kind of, like New Age neo-Puritanism, where, you know, your body is a temple and you need to be doing sunrise yoga every day and drinking spirulina smoothies and, you know, running every day. It's all about kind of this, it's a kind of asceticism, but it's secular, right? It's not explicitly religious. And people who are committed to that also are very skeptical of chemical intoxicants. But it's because I think they're ignoring the functions it's played. So alcohol increases creativity. So there's really good data, I view like an experimental data, direct and indirect evidence for this, that if you're facing a creative problem, having a little bit of alcohol is helpful. It actually relaxes your prefrontal cortex and allows parts of your brain to start communicating in ways they wouldn't otherwise. And that's super important for humans because we're dependent on creativity in a way that no other species is. We're completely dependent on tools and technology. If you threw humans into the wilderness without tools, they'd be dead in a day or two, unlike other animals. And so we're dependent on creativity. And I think that's one of the reasons we've turned to tools like alcohol. We also have to cooperate in ways that are weird for a primate. So we're primates, we're biologically primates. And yet if you look at, I'm looking out at downtown Vancouver, and if you look at cities like this, it really looks more like a beehive or an ant colony than a habitation of primates. We cooperate on this massive scale and with an intensity that looks a lot more like social insects than primates. And social insects pull that off because they're genetically identical. They're basically one big, you can look at them as kind of one big organism. How primates do that is a bit more mysterious. And what I'm arguing in the book and some of my previous work is that there are various cultural tools we use to do that. And religion's one of them, but alcohol is another. It reduces our inhibitions. It makes us makes it harder for us to lie. It makes us better at detecting lies. It increases endorphins and serotonins. It makes us like other people more. It helps us to bond with one another. So it's a tool that we've used to help relax our suspicious primate nature and allow us to cooperate in the ways we need to cooperate.
Yeah, so you've covered quite a few things to unpack here, and I'll try to remember all of them, but I'll start backwards. So one of the things you mention in the book is you talk about how children are a bit more friendly and what we would refer to as naive. And as you get older, your prefrontal cortex becomes a bit more rigid. You become more suspicious of those around you. And alcohol helps, as we've seen in first dates, we've seen in business meetings, we've seen in the signing of treaties, where you come together over food and drink to break ice, to get to know each other and to understand each other in a deeper way. And that's absolutely the case. I mean, one of the things we do locally is we do this annual whiskey festival, right? So we are inviting 2,000 people and 400 different spirits from all over the world. And a lot of us will get to know each other in these local Facebook groups. And then we get to come together over drinks in real life and through bottle shares and tastings and these classes. It's just a way that there are people that I have never even met in person, but we interact so much online through the passion over whiskey that we would consider each other genuine friends. Like we've bonded in that way. And it's one of the more fascinating aspects because it's the exact same thing that happens when it comes to creativity. As you said, children are all about this imagination and this creativity. Mm-hmm. And it's as they get older, it becomes harder for them to not their prefrontal cortex to get in the way of that, right? Like they're so rigid. Yeah. And what I thought was extremely fascinating is in, I think it's the last chapter, you talk about the fact that glossolalia, speaking in tongues, there were tests done that basically saw that you were experiencing the same physiological reaction with your prefrontal cortex through being drunk on God and actually drinking alcohol. So you could achieve some of the similar effects through exercise and through running and, but the idea that we used to call it that growing up whenever somebody was, asleep at the altar and just kind of making these noises and these gyrations, that they were drunk on the spirit. That's what we would call it. And it made me realize that there are things that come to people. Like if you're an artist and you drink alcohol, you find the right chord or the right song, or you write this beautiful thing. And vice versa, if you're a religious person, through prayer and this extreme worship, that you maybe have a revelation, a realization of something in your life. And what we would refer to is that God was speaking to you. Mm-hmm. And it's the exact same physiological chemical reaction, whether you're drinking alcohol and drunk on the spirit.
Yeah, absolutely. It's harder to do without alcohol, but you can do it, right? So I don't know what practices you guys would do to get into a state where you could...
Music.
Usually. The spirit could enter you. Yeah, so music, singing.
Start with music, you start dancing, listen to soulful things, and, you start praising and lifting your hands. And the idea that through that practice of relaxing the prefrontal cortex to a point that they have an inspiration or a thought or an answer to something that's going on in their life. Mm-hmm. And that being the same exact thing as literally drinking alcohol, which is a shortcut. It's a lot easier.
It's a shortcut.
It's like I think you refer to it as a hack, hacking the body. It was one of the most prolific, fascinating things to process, coming from that realm to where I am now in my own personal life. The book is absolutely, it's incredible. My hat's off to you. I was blown away by it. And of course I had a few drinks while listening and reading.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But it's for someone who, was told my whole life that alcohol is a bad, that to never actually see that badness, right? Like, of course you see people who drink and, I think you mentioned there's an increased rate of rape and sexual assault and men's ability to process, body mannerisms as flirting or not flirting. We've all been to a sports bar and seen it.
Yeah.
To see all of these negatives, but also to know. So, I mean, there's an entire spirits industry of people who are educators and master distillers and blenders who drink every day as part of their employment, but don't have those same issues, the things you hear growing up, the scary stuff. So what happens, just like anything, when you're being told something as a kid that everything is bad, 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 and then you realize, well, this is not that bad. Like if things are quite, you can see that the positive in things like in booze or, growing up, women weren't allowed to cut their hair. They had to wear skirts. You couldn't wear jeans. And to realize that all of those things are really just there are ways in which we as people, we feel good when we sacrifice things, right? Like when you rob yourself of, and this is a big part of religion, when you have the discipline to not have a TV in your house or to not,
yeah.
We weren't allowed to go to movie theaters because those are dark mm-hmm. places.
No, they're costly displays, right? So it's good, successful religion. So this is work I've done with colleagues in anthropology and cultural evolution, are ones that make you do costly things. That's how you show that you're really an honest, believing member. So, getting not dancing, not watching TV, not doing pleasurable things that people around you are doing is a really good signaling device. And so one of the things I argue is if you look at, for instance, Mormonism, and I think this is equally true of Pentecostalism, the ban on alcohol really, and especially like the Mormons ban, I don't know, do Pentecostals ban stimulants as well? Can you drink coffee?
Yeah, so no, we're okay with coffee. And I'm glad you're about to bring this up because there is a debate within the Pentecostal church. Why is coffee okay?
Yeah.
But alcohol's not.
Yeah.
In Mormons, it's a complete ban of both.
Yeah. So if you were really, if the ban was targeted at the costs of intoxication, you'd expect it to be more targeted. But the fact that the Mormons, for instance, are just banning everything really has all the markers of a costly display. This is something we're doing to mark ourselves off from the people around us. This is something we're doing to mark ourselves off from the people around us and also to demonstrate our obedience and our dedication to this religion. Because if I didn't really believe in God, why would I do this? Why would I give up all this wonderful stuff that other people, fun stuff that other people are doing? So it's a very effective way for religions to, it's a kind of membership cost. So, cause you get benefits, right? When you become part of the religion, you get access to a network of people who will help you, cooperate with you, trust you, give you things, but you've got to demonstrate that you're really one of us. And this is one of the ways that religions do it is by asking you to do these costly things. So that's where a lot of the bans on intoxicants really seem to be more signaling than a kind of cultural response to the specific problems of alcohol itself. Because as you say, they're trying to get the same effects in other ways. So, the speaking in tongues, it was interesting you said you have this feeling that God's speaking to you, right? You have an insight and you don't feel like it came from you. You feel like it came from somewhere else.
And it happens during these moments.
It happens during these moments because you've downregulated the PFC. And basically, I mean, cognitively, what I would say is happening is you're getting some direct communications from your unconscious, parts of your brain that don't maybe are normally suppressed or don't normally talk to one another or talking to one another. And I had actually a secular version of this happen to me. So I had written about 10 different versions of the proposal for the book, and it just wasn't gelling. Like my agent was like, no, I don't want to send this out yet.
There's not good.
There's no pop. It didn't pop. I had all the information. I had all the arguments. All the science was there, but it was boring. And she was right. She's good. So I was like, yeah, you're right. And then I realized I hadn't written any of it drunk. That was the problem. I hadn't taken my own advice. And so I was on a business trip and I was supposed to go out to dinner with some colleagues, but I had a couple hours before dinner. And so I went down to the hotel bar with my laptop and I ordered a Negroni. And I think I had the Negroni and I think I ordered a second and I was about to sip into the second Negroni when the first page of what's now the first page of the book was delivered to me by some other part of my brain that did not feel like me. I really, the experience felt like just taking dictation. I was like, oh, this is how to start it. And I just was typing and someone else was telling me what to write is what it felt like. And if I were a religious person, I think I would describe it in terms of God speaking to me or getting right. Revelation. But really what it is part of your brain that's normally suppressed or, is being censored or filtered, actually getting to just say relax. What it thinks. So, and that's where insights come. So, I can't say how many people have said that it's their favorite first line of a book they've ever read. A lot of my interviews start with people quoting that first line. That came from 0.08 BAC.
The legal limit in Texas, yeah. The very first line of the book, the very first sentence is, people like to masturbate. And is that what you're referring to, or the quote?
Yeah, I was just like, let's do that. People like to masturbate. That's a good way to start a book.
Yeah, and I know you've discussed it, and you don't have to go into it too deeply, but if you want to skim the idea of why that was the first line, meaning the hacking versus, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, read the second line, because people like to masturbate, and then what was the exact wording?
Okay, the second line is, they also like to get drunk and eat Twinkies. Not typically at the same time, but that's a matter of personal preference.
Yeah, so masturbation, Twinkies, and drinking. And I raise those three vices because from a scientific perspective, what we've been told until now is that they're the same. They're all evolutionary mistakes. And so masturbation is a classic example of what's called a hijack. So we've got this reward circuit.
No pun
intended. We're not going to go there. But you've got, you have a reward that evolution gives you. Evolution gives you rewards for doing what it wants you to do. And its central interest is getting copies of your genes into the next generation. And the orgasm, the best thing that can happen to you, its best reward it can dole out to you is reserved for the thing that's most directly relevant to that, which is reproductive sex. And it's the case that historically over time, orgasms have been associated statistically with reproductive sex often enough that that's a pretty good strategy. And yet humans have been gaming the system for a really long time. We've been engaging in all sorts of reproductive sex. We'll do all sorts of things to get an orgasm. So that's a hijack. That's when we're getting a reward. We're triggering a reward system, even though we're not doing the thing that the reward's actually supposed to be for. But hijacks like that can continue when the costs are not very high. And the costs of non-reproductive sex are not very high. So evolution it's not hot and bothered about that because it's getting the job done more or less.
Yeah, I've got four kids, so I'm with you.
And you've probably masturbated even as a Pentecostal, probably not as a Pentecostal, but you manage to still have four kids. So the other type of mistake is what I call a mismatch. That's what Twinkies are the classic example of, junk food. We have a taste for sugar and fat. When we encounter sugar and fat, we tend to eat as much of it as we can. This was adaptive in our evolutionary past. So sugar and fat were rare. They were hard to find. When you got them, you should really consume them right away. But it becomes maladaptive now. So when we have access to Twinkies, it becomes maladaptive. When we have access to junk food and all these things that are, you know, sugary, soda pop,
destroying us, yeah,
it's bad. It causes all these problems. But this is the mismatch only very recently. So having unlimited access to sugar and fats, pretty recent thing, last 100 years or so, and it's still geographically pretty limited. There are parts of the world, in fact, parts of the United States where getting enough sugar and fat is a problem for people. So mismatches can happen when the change is relatively recent or geographically limited. It's only in a few parts of the world. Alcohol is not like either one of those things. It's, first of all, super costly. So unlike masturbation, it's got all these physiological and other costs. It's also not recent and not localized. We've been making and consuming alcohol probably for at least 20,000 years, certainly for 13,000 years. The earliest direct evidence we have is we have beer making 13,000 years ago in the Fertile Crescent. That's a really long time. And we've been doing it around the world. We've been doing it everywhere. And so the taste for alcohol's gotta be different in a very fundamental way from our taste for masturbation or Twinkies. So that's why I start off the book talking about those three things.
Sure. And one of the things you discuss, which you've already kind of mentioned, is you know, hunter-gatherers would come upon and discover low-dose alcohol through fermentation of leftover fruit or things just starting to rot. Yeah. And that actually led to us trying to ramp that up, to make that on purpose, which then led to agriculture. So yeah. the beer before bread theory.
Yeah.
So I know that you go into this quite a bit of basically making the argument that the evidence really does point to that because of the production about the purposeful production of alcohol, that's what led to modern civilization at the very beginning. How, what's the collective thought on that within the scientific community? Is it a definite thing or is it still up for debate? Where are we leaning in that theory?
Yeah, the standard story has always been, in the same way that it's, you know, taste for alcohol is an evolutionary mistake, the story has been that our possession of alcohol is a mistake. So we had agriculture first. At some point, we left grain sitting around for too long, bread making stuff sitting around for too long, and it started to ferment. And we were like, oh, wow, that tastes good. And then we had beer. The evidence, is it a majority of archaeologists now? You'd have to poll archaeologists on this, but it's a very strong, relatively recent movement, the beer before bread movement. But people pointing out that hunter-gatherers were making alcohol in an organized way long before we had agriculture. So we know they were making beer in the Fertile Crescent 13,000 years ago. Agriculture is not that old. We know that they were gathering. I talk about the site Göbekli Tepe in present day Turkey, where hunter gatherers were gathering to erect these crazy monuments. I mean, these huge stone pillars that they had to cut and drag and carve animal shapes on. And then they were performing some kind of rituals. We don't know what. And then they were feasting. So we have the remains of feasts. We have all these animal bones and things like that. And then we have these big vats that contain liquid of some kind. And I'm pretty sure it wasn't water. You know, they were drinking. We know they were making beer in this part of the world at this point. It wouldn't be surprising if they were making hallucinogen-laced beer. Humans often kind of gave their beer an extra kick by adding some hallucinogens to it. But the argument is that this is why we started paying attention to plants more and saying, hey, this particular plant gave us some good beer. Let's try to plant more of that. And so the drive to settle down and start domesticating plants came from a drive to get drunk, not a drive to produce more food. And so that's the sense in which quite literally intoxication gave rise to civilization.
Yeah, one of the things you talk about, which you've already mentioned as well, is that the medical community, just from a nutritional standpoint, their feelings are that alcohol has no net positive effects. There's no safe level of alcohol consumption. And one of the greatest immediate follow-up sentences in this book is you saying, well, there's no safe level of driving either. Like, no. Objectively, you can't, but no one would ever argue to not drive.
Yeah.
So, one of the, as you have done this research, how persistent, especially with, I guess, someone who would be just making the argument from a nutritional perspective, how persistent or resistant to counter arguments like being able to drive, there's no safe level of flying. If you really think about flying, it's literally controlled crashing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, right now, our conversations around alcohol use. So do we use alcohol? Should individuals use it? Should organizations use it? Should alcohol be allowed at public events? Do you include it at your office parties? When we're trying to make these decisions, I think we've been flying blind. So all we've been guided by is this physiological stuff. And that's not enough information. And so at the end of the day, whether or not an individual should use alcohol in their life, individual personal life, whether or not your office holiday party should be dry or not, these are decisions that don't have clear answers because it depends on what your risk tolerance is. It depends on what your goals are. Do you want, you know, is your office party something that's going to be important for building, you know, loyalty to the company? And do you want new ideas to come out of this? Or is it just, you know, a quick thank you to the employees and then we go home? I'm not telling anyone what the answer to this question is. All I'm saying is that you can't intelligently make a decision unless you consider all of the factors, and those include these positive benefits. So let's acknowledge the fact that alcohol is a dangerous substance. It hurts your liver, raises your cancer risk. Let's acknowledge that probably a good maybe 15% of the human population is genetically prone to alcoholism. And if you have those genes, it's hard for you to use alcohol safely. So all this stuff is going to vary individual to individual and depending on what your goals in the moment are. But let's have an intelligent discussion about it. Let's consider all of the benefits as well as the costs, because otherwise we're not going to make good decisions.
Yeah. And one of the things that you go into detail about is the creative the massive technology change that has happened because of intoxicants. And the book's not just talking about alcohol. You also cover LSD, the development of the microchip. And in most cases, and again, if I say anything technically wrong, fix me. But in most cases where prohibition was enforced, you saw a decline in patent applications.
This is a particular study. So this economist, and I think this is still unpublished, but he took advantage of a natural experiment. So what's the effect of banning alcohol on group creativity and innovation? You could do an experiment where you take two companies and one bans alcohol and one allows it in the workplace. That would be an experiment. Or you could take advantage of natural experiments. And so this guy took advantage of a natural experiment, the imposition of prohibition in the US. And so we tend to think of prohibition as something that happened all at once, all over the country, but it didn't. It was imposed on a county level, county by county, and then at the state level. So he had variation in when prohibition was imposed. And what he did was he looked at counties that were previously wet, that where you could go to saloons and buy alcohol freely. And he looked at what happened when prohibition was imposed on those counties. And what you find is a decrease of 15% in patent applications, which is a pretty big decrease. And then it rebounds to its previous level three years later. And his theory is that what's going on is that people still drank. They drank bootleg liquor. They'd make liquor at home. But they were drinking kind of like we've been drinking in the pandemic. They were drinking all cooped up at home alone, which is not healthy drinking, and it's not very productive in terms of creativity. And so he thinks what happens after 3 years is the creation of speakeasies and other ways to drink socially in a way that was underground gave people social drinking back again.
They gave them their outlet.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think that's an important study because what I suspect, it's too soon to know, but I suspect that the pandemic is going to have the same sort of negative effect on innovation. So, you know, conferences have been canceled. People aren't traveling for work. People aren't socializing over beers and talking about stuff. I think we're going to see a marked decrease in innovation when we look back at this, especially during the pandemic and the immediate aftermath.
I wonder if there's going to be a correlation or if you could even prove it, a correlation between these outbreak pockets where, you know, like in some cases, I know that there have been pictures and videos of Florida beaches being flooded by people who basically ignored protocols. If you were to see a difference in, say, Los Angeles, which went completely on lockdown, where it was just drinking at home, versus like if you were to see a dip in innovation in those specific spots versus places that flat out ignored all protocol.
Yeah, no, that would be interesting. So that would be the variation that you would want, right? You could look at places that were really heavy hit by COVID and had to really lock down hard, and places that remained relatively open. But the overall effect has got to be negative. And I think people are really, when Skype was invented, there was this claim that, business travel is going to stop because why would you go travel. Why would you go to conferences anymore if you have Skype? And yet business travel and conference travel remain completely unchanged until the pandemic.
And growing.
Yeah. And growing. And it's because if you're going to sign a contract with someone for anything more complex than making you paper clips, anything where there's any leeway for things to go wrong, you're going to get on a plane and you're going to sit with them and you're going to drink with them. You'll eat, but you'll also drink. And because you want to see what they're like after a few drinks. People still go to in-person conferences, but I predict that after the pandemic, despite all the concerns about carbon footprints and everything else, academics are going to start flying to in-person conferences again. Because, you know, you can watch the talks online, you can see poster sessions online, but what you don't get online is the running into someone at the hotel bar and having a beer and talking about something you never thought you would talk about and you never would have planned to talk about. And a new collaboration comes out of that, or you learn something important for your own work that you wouldn't have learned otherwise.
Oh, for sure. For years I worked for an aviation company that it's the largest private aviation firm in the world. They didn't handle commercial flights. It was only private charter, military, and medical. So all your Fortune 500 companies, anyone with a private jet, all of those meetings were heavily pushed to in person. We would send people to those, like, you know, if you've got a Starbucks, the head of Starbucks, we're going to go visit them. We're going to go to Seattle. We're going to have steak dinner, and there's going to be booze. All of our conferences for the industry within aviation world took place in Vegas. There's always going to be this need of a better business relationship through bonding over spirit and food and wine. One of the things you mentioned that I think plays a big part of it is whether or not your company has an HR department.
And there are genuine worries. I mean, HR departments are justified in being a little worried about this. And it's their job to be worried about it. And I do at the end of the book talk about some of the dangers, right? So if you're socializing, if networking professionally is done at hotel bars in Vegas, it's fine. Dudes are going to be really comfortable with that. Women maybe less so. Women may not be thrilled about the idea of doing networking and professional work where they're required to be in a bar situation with a bunch of guys who are down regulating their prefrontal cortices. People who don't drink for a variety of reasons, because they're Pentecostal or they're Muslim or they're a recovering alcoholic or they have alcoholic relatives and they just don't like the idea of drinking. They're pregnant. They just don't like alcohol. They have to get up early, take the kids to daycare. There's a lot of ways in which people who don't drink are locked out of the bonding that happens when it's done over alcohol. And that's where I think there's work that organizations can do to mitigate that danger, the inequity there. You have to make people who aren't drinking feel comfortable. There have to be a lot of non-alcoholic options freely available and as easy to get as getting alcoholic options. These things should be done at times that are friendly to people who have kids, you know, not 10 o'clock at night, right? There are just simple things you could do. You should limit drinking. So I think one thing organizations have intelligently started doing is, you know, having drink tickets and not having a full open bar. Because especially if you're serving distilled liquors, things can go sideways really quickly. So there's dangers to all this. You know, the benefits always come with a downside.
It's no different than food, right? I mean, you can have food can be great, but it can be extremely dangerous, as you said, Twinkies. But in the book, you talk about just simply having a glass of water already on the table, as well as offering a bunch of non-alcoholic options. You automatically see a decrease in the rate of consumption. And so one of the things that I found stimulating in the book is because we throw this whiskey festival every year, it starts at 5 p.m. for most people. The event's over at 9 and you've got 400 plus spirits in the room. How do you help set a precedence of more responsible drinking, especially for 2,000 people? So over the years, we've learned little things. We've learned smaller portions. There's something in at spirits tastings referred to as the dump bucket or the spit bucket.
So you
just by having them on the table,
it encourages people to not just down the whole thing. Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
Doubling up on the amount of water available at the event, spring water, and having more of those stations around. We've noticed every year you're going to have some people who just don't know any better, right? I've told this horror story on the show quite a bit of this very wealthy older woman who was fresh out of stomach surgery, shouldn't be drinking at all. And she came to one of these events, and within an hour, she was quite inebriated, even after a couple of drinks, because she just had her stomach stapled.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So there are things that are just absolutely horrific. But over time, we see less and less people. And we wondered, is it because the city didn't have these events a few years ago, and now they're more rampant and more well-known, so people come prepared more? Is it the fact that we, doubled up on water or partnered with Uber? Or what exactly, why are we seeing a decrease, a growth in the event, but a decrease in wild behavior? Mm-hmm. And it's something that the book on its own, it's something that me as, especially from a liability perspective, it's something that we have to consider. Why are we seeing less and less drunk behavior and more and more, safe behavior?
That's great.
The book's fascinating. I cannot recommend it enough. I really can't thank you enough. There was one other thing I wanted to ask you about, because you went right into distilling liquid quite a bit. I misunderstood this. You said distilling liquor is only how old is distilled liquor? Because I know that one of your favorites, Lagavulin 16, is 205 years old. Distillery.
Yeah.
So, how old is distillation?
In Europe, it's on a wide scale, like where your average person would have access to it, it's like 1600s, 1700s. So that may seem like a really long time ago, but I'm telling a story that starts 10 million years ago with our primate ancestors adapting to fermenting fruit. So, and you know, where we start making alcohol on a large scale 20,000 years ago, 300 years ago, 400 years ago is pretty recent. So in Europe, it's relatively recent. In China, probably earlier. So possibly as early as the 1300s. But it's a relatively recent innovation, because even though it's distillation's a simple concept, it's actually hard to pull off technically. It's hard. You need to have metallurgy. You need to be able to precisely control temperatures. You need to be able to contain hot liquids under pressure, which can sometimes go awry, as people have discovered, people during Prohibition discovered when they tried to set up home stills. So it's tricky to master technically, and that's why we didn't have it until relatively late. And what I argue in the book is distilled liquors are really a game changer. They're just so much more powerful than what we adapted to drinking. So for most of our evolutionary history, we were drinking like 2-3% beers, and fruit wines maybe would get to 8%, 9%. But with modern yeast now, we could make stronger beers and wines, but still there's an upper cap, because the yeast poison themselves, right? They're produced, alcohol's poison, and they eventually poison themselves as well. So the strongest you can get through natural fermentation is about 16, maybe 17%. So these kind of crazy Australian alcoholic fruit bombs that can get that high. But you use distillation, suddenly you can make a 90-something% ABV vodka. And that is scary if you think about it from an evolutionary perspective. That's a concentration of ethanol that's really unprecedented.
The very first patent on especially the difference between the pot still and the column still. So the column distillation is our most efficient distillation process, right? You can hit vodkas at distillation proofs above 190, which is almost pure alcohol. And that's only since the 1815s, pre 1830. The column distillation patent was filed around that time. So you're talking about a completely perfected distillation process for pure alcohol that's less than 200 years old, and we're over here putting it in all of our fruits and beverages.
So my argument is that in the modern world, alcohol may be more dangerous than it's been historically. Because of distillation, we have access to these incredibly powerful, if 0.08 BAC is about the sweet spot for most of the benefits of alcohol, for creativity, socializing, if you're drinking a 2-3% beer, you're going to stay about that level. If you're drinking vodka, if you're doing shots of vodka, you just blow right past 0.08 and right into really dangerous territory very quickly. It's much, and then the dangers for addiction and other things become much higher. So distilled liquors are super dangerous. So one just takeaways, I'm a fan of whiskey. But I have to say that after doing the research on the book, I drink less whiskey. I hate to say that on your podcast, but, just in the sense that I'm a little more worried about it. Like I'm aware that it's a real, you know, I still drink it. I love scotch. But I guess I have more respect for its power when I realize just how much more, potent it is than wines and beers.
Well, I definitely, it is something that you need to be concerned with, especially within the hobby. One of our things, you know, we all start drinking Jack and Coke, right? That's and then your beers as well. Then you move from whiskey with water and ice, then whiskey, a couple drops of water, and then you're drinking whiskey by itself. Whiskey Neat, name of the show. And in the hobby specifically, there is an extreme push for higher proof spirits. One of my favorite bottles, one that we picked for this show. This is Amrut. It's an Indian single malt. It's 120 proof.
60% alcohol. 60, that's really strong.
Yeah. And you drink it neat, you know, no water, no nothing. It's something that you definitely have to be careful of. But I do like the kind of, I don't think you were necessarily pushing it this way, but the book makes it pretty clear that drinking alone is probably not your best bet. All the dangers of alcohol kind of go through the roof when you're home alone, just knocking back whiskey. Yeah. You know, thank God for my wife. We usually drink together, so I feel better about it. Where can people find you? Give a shout out. I know that you, if I remember correctly, I don't think you're not big on public Instagram, right? That's more like your private thing.
Yeah, I don't really do Instagram. My publicist made me get an account, but I don't really even know how to use it. I do use Twitter, but the best way to get in touch with me or find out about my work is just my website. So it's edwardslingerland.com. Edward Slingerland, just one word, .com. So pretty easy to find.
Yeah, I love the interview you did with Rogan and him giving you a hard time about you pronouncing your own name.
Yeah, that was hilarious. Yeah, that was, the whole thing was quite a trip. Yeah.
Well, listen, thanks so much for doing the show. I love the book. I cannot wait to start Trying Not to Try.
All right. Yeah.
I finished this 2 days ago and I immediately bought the book. So it hasn't come in yet, but I'm thoroughly excited. I love the discussion and I can't thank you enough for doing the show.
Great. Thanks for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Cheers.
Balcones' first ever year-round bourbon was an inspiration. It all had to work together. A blend of carefully selected ingredients, Texas-sized pot stills, and creative people determined to find the absolute best way to usher a new whiskey along. When you discover how it pairs with a meaningful moment, suddenly the feeling of drinking great whiskey becomes a whole lot more.